Why would an American citizen get a military funeral in another country?
Why would an American citizen get a military funeral in another country? I have no idea.
Robert Maxwell.
Oh. You want to go there, huh? You want to talk about the Epstein, huh? He's a Mossad agent. Yeah. Just like Jeffrey.
What do you think the possibility is that left-wing content creators will be subject to the same level of deplatforming and debanking that some of the far-right creators experienced in the last few years?
It's certainly possible, if not probable. We're already seeing some level of suppression around content around that. Anytime anybody interviews an American doctor who went to Gaza or just any doctor who went to Gaza, immediate, they get nuked by the algorithm. Right. Theo Vaughn just did an interview with one of these people. And after like almost 24 hours, he was barely cracking 100,000 views. This is a Theo Vaughn video we're talking about. This should be in the millions.
Multiple millions,
right? Yep. And so that's one example. I know many others, you know, Breaking Points, they've also interviewed doctors in Gaza. Same thing. Mm-hmm. And at first you think, oh, it's the title, it's the thumbnail. Maybe I did something wrong here. No, there's a decision made on the back end, algorithm. We're gonna kill this thing.
There is.
And so, and I've noticed that as well with just my videos. I haven't talked to a doctor in Gaza, but my coverage of Gaza in general. At the beginning, you know, it was 400,000 views per Gaza segment. And I was doing these really long segments giving all the updates. In the middle, attention sort of tapered off a little bit, which to some extent, you know, I get it. But now that we're looking at what is...
Is that anomalous or normal in like the viewer retention curve?
I think it's relatively normal. Okay. But what's happening now is basically the final solution in front of our eyes. Mm. And so interest is peaking again. And the views are not following that.
Right.
And so it leads me to believe that they're basically choking it off in the algorithm on the back end, which is something that we've dealt with before. I mean, I was on YouTube during the whole Adpocalypse era where they decided like that, we're done with political content because there was some Nestle ad that ran on a white nationalist YouTube channel. They cut off all the funding for political channels. And so they have a lot of control of what makes it and what doesn't make it. And to your point, they really, really don't want people talking about this issue. They really don't.
The way, going back to that era of 2012, the way all of these platforms were pitched was that they were removing gatekeepers, right? They were disintermediating the discourse. They were liberating people. They were giving everyone a voice, right? You can just upload whatever you think. And the idea was that, you know, naturally the best narratives, the truth would rise to the top and there would be no one kind of like, you know, pulling levers behind the scenes. I'm not supposed to say stuff like this. I'm not sure who I'm going to get in trouble, but like there are people who... And every day they talk to political groups that are lobbying how they interpret the TOS. So the idea that, you know, this is just everyone freely voicing their opinion and is disintermediated or not subject to political pressure is completely untrue. And you can just observe that plainly, quantitatively, through what things perform irregularly. Or you can just like talk to the people who work there and they'll tell you themselves.
Right. Yeah. And now there's just new gatekeepers, right?
Yeah, yeah.
YouTube, in a sense, has become its own version of the mainstream,
right.
And things are sort of fragmented and segmented out in corners. And, you know, I do feel like to some extent, there's a little bit of a cap on how big political YouTube can get.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, YouTube doesn't want to be like some ridiculously high percentage political. They want to be the place where you go for, hey, there's a makeup tutorial or this thing or that thing. And it's just one of those things where, you know, I kind of felt that even getting into this, that there's kind of a cap on what we're doing here, but, you know, it's the only game in town at the moment, really.
I've been privately wondering about this, but people will say, or rather YouTube specifically will say, that audiences want this very consistent, like the same type of content, you know, every upload you make. If you're a video game content creator, you make the same level of Minecraft, you explore that to death. And I'm not totally convinced that that narrative is actually serving what audiences want, right? They say that shows that have a variety of perspectives, right? Like a variety show, a talk show, so to speak, is not desired by audiences and that there's maximum engagement for very consistent, narrow niche content. I think that we've kind of allowed that narrative to continue because YouTube has been a multi-decade hegemon without any real source of competition. And I think that that was their kind of subjective, what they thought audiences wanted. And if there was a kind of competing source, then yeah, we might see a little bit more diversity. We might see less echo chambers. We might see less ideological quarantine and things like that. What is your feeling about the current YouTube algorithm and how that partitions audiences?
Jeez, oh, man, I don't know. I really don't know. I would say that for me, people do come looking for consistency, looking for the same thing. Everybody's looking for confirmation bias to one extent or another, regardless of what they say. But YouTube, I mean, think about the different people who've blown up on YouTube. There was like a Ben Shapiro era on YouTube. You have people like me. You have people like Destiny. You have the Young Turks. You have, you know, all across the ideological spectrum. And I do think that like the one consistent thing is, can you make a good title? Can you make a good thumbnail? Can you hook people from the very beginning? If you do that, I feel like then the algorithm blesses you.
Right.
If you can't do that, if you can't get past that initial barrier to entry, then I think you're screwed. And I think we have really poor attention spans these days.
Yes.
So that's why the title and the thumbnail, like the first 2 minutes of the video, really have to hook somebody in.
Yeah. Yeah. I always go back to this example, but I think it was 1967. There was an hour and a half debate on public television of Michael Harrington and William F. Buckley debating uninterrupted.
Yep.
And now people can't sit through like a 15-second TikTok. So
that's
our attention has certainly been degraded in that time. You've been on YouTube for 17, 18 years now?
Started in 2012 full time.
Yeah.
I started as a hobby in 08.
Right.
So I'm ancient. Yeah.
I did. I went back and watched some of your very, very early videos.
I apologize.
In anticipation of this. How do you feel that the platform itself has changed within that time?
I would say it's gotten more right wing.
Sure.
I would say that when I first started, there wasn't many political people on there.
Right.
You had the Young Turks, you had David Pakman, you had myself. We were like the only political people. And then as time went by, you saw the rise of the Steven Crowders and the Ben Shapiros and, you know, the anti-social justice warrior type content.
Right.
And it went from a largely apolitical, maybe slightly leaning left platform to a very right-leaning platform. And I think that sort of echoed what was happening in the country, right? When I started in 08, Obama had just gotten elected.
Yeah.
And, you know, it felt like there's a little bit of a air of optimism out there. And over time, when that sort of faded with Obama, then you get the Trump era and the media sort of, you know, reflected that. I think that's where we are now. Yeah.
Is there a certain era of YouTube? Like people talk about new atheism as a very influential force. Mm-hmm. Like how do you bracket out these different eras?
I don't know. That's a good question. I feel like they kind of overlap. The new atheism thing, I was a part of that too. So I got my political awakening from reading Noam Chomsky and reading Richard Dawkins at the same time. Yeah. Now that seems ridiculous because, you know.
This is great. Yeah.
New atheism sort of eventually cut in a right-wing direction, but originally it wasn't. Originally it wasn't right-wing at all.
Yeah.
It was just about being against religious dogmas of all kind, including Christian dogma. Eventually they hyper-focused on Muslims and made it very creepy. But so Richard Dawkins, Noam Chomsky, they kind of gave me my political awakening. So you have strident atheism in there and a left-wing worldview. And yeah, for the rest is history.
I had this conversation recently, and it took me by surprise, but it really helped put a few pieces together. A lot of people who made this kind of like, let's say we bracket out these YouTube eras, 2008 to 2012, 2012 to 2016, there's this like huge rift that opens up, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people kind of go towards the right. This kind of early, what we at the time called the alt-right, I think mistakenly, but counter-signaling social justice warriors.
Right.
And a lot of people would say, yeah, I used to be part of the left. And what they meant by that, just in hindsight, I've recently put this together. I think what they meant by that is they saw new atheism as a rational, progressive, secularizing force in society.
I see what you're saying.
And that was their concept of the left at that time. Does that track with your experience of this period?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's fair.
Do you know people who were maybe part of your peer group starting out and then broke off in a different direction?
I mean, I think there was a lot of, if you think of somebody like Sargon of Akkad,
yes.
He started out as like, oh, I'm a liberal, I'm a classical liberal, and I'll argue for those liberal positions. And then over time, it just got further and further right wing and like a hyper focus on liberals and leftists and Democrats and all of their excesses and just totally overlooking insane evangelical Christian stuff and, you know, far right authoritarian stuff and white nationalist stuff. And eventually a lot of these people, they ended up either becoming white nationalists or flirting with white nationalists. And, you know, now we're dealing with the fallout of that today because it has gotten to its logical conclusion with the rise of somebody who's kind of open about his white nationalism, Nick Fuentes, for example.
Right.
And so there's this weird thing that happens where it always goes to the lowest common denominator, right? Where it may have started out with like they were flirting with the right, but then eventually you go far enough down that track and now Nick Fuentes is like the number one right-wing streamer in the country.
Right.
You could argue it's him or maybe Asmund Gold, who represents a different kind of conservatism.
Yeah.
But that's something that I've been thinking about and worrying about a lot recently is that I don't know, the internet always seems to take it to the lowest common denominator, and that ends up being the thing that's popular. You might have a moment where it's a more moderate stance, but over time, it just always gets to the worst version of it, you know?
Yeah. The incentive structure is overwhelming, I think. Quickly, I don't want to miss this this anecdote about Dawkins, but he's now calling himself a cultural Christian.
I did see that. Yeah. And that just all stems from these people hate Muslims, right? They hate Muslims and they hyper-focus on that. And I find it particularly egregious and pathetic at a time when we're witnessing a live stream genocide in Gaza and innocent Muslims are getting killed on a daily basis. To hyper-focus on that seems comically racist. And if you don't want to use the word racist, because, you know, religion is not a race, it's bigoted. It's bigoted. And, you know, you saw this echoed in Sam Harris at the time when he first came out. And now, you know, but that, I mean, the whole new atheism thing, it really is a dying breed at the moment. I don't see many people, you know, in that category anymore.
Yeah. What is your idea of the political center? Because this is a moving target and different people characterize that, locate that differently. What is your idea of the center of politics?
There's so many different ways to define that, right? The center could be the center as it exists in Washington right now, which would be like a Joe Manchin type cretin. Right? That's one version definition of center. Another definition of center is who's smack dab in the center of mainstream American opinion. And by that logic, I would say a lot of the things I advocate for, the things Bernie Sanders advocates for, you know, you look at any poll, they want a higher minimum wage, they want to raise taxes on the rich, they want universal health care. And so that could be another definition of center. So I feel like the entire conversation around being a centrist is a little bit difficult to have because people are usually working off different definitions as to what kind of centrism they mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying this out. I don't know if it's successful, but the idea that like New Deal liberalism, basically from post-war up until the mid-1970s, what if that was actually the center of liberal democracy? And then neoliberalism is a shift towards privatization, towards the capitalist class. And what if we chose to define the center actually in that like compact between labor and capital, and then actually like moving to social democracy is a really marginal shift, actually?
You're expressing what I think is correct. I think that true centrism was, you know, FDR's New Deal. True centrism is having a strong social safety net. Is giving people jobs in a depression to help them get out of the depression, right? That actually is moderation. That actually is being centrist. And that's why the era we're living in feels so extreme and insane, is because now it's like the government doesn't even care about people's problems, right? You look at a scenario where millions of people are uninsured. You look at a scenario where medical bills are the number one cause of bankruptcy. And in a world that made sense, that would be a five-alarm fire. That would be an emergency session of Congress where they try to get relief to these people. But they don't care. It's been the case for so long. Nobody cares. Nobody does anything. Nobody even talks about it, right? And that's why the era we're living in is so extreme and insane. And that era, I mean, that was the last time Americans really had hope. Where they felt like, you know, the next generation is going to be better than my generation. My kids are going to do better than me.
And it was.
And
they
felt,
and
that's right. And they felt confident in saying that. They felt comfortable. Now, nobody thinks that.
No.
Nobody. You have kids now, and I do. I'm a stepdad. You go, what kind of fucking world are we leaving the kids?
How much worse is it going to be?
How much worse is it going to be, right? With climate collapse and, you know, the economy going to be absolutely cooked. Like, what? And so that's the problem, is I would love it if we could get back to a place like that. But, you know, that would require just utterly obliterating the right and making Democrats wake up to what they used to be in order to get there.
I mean, there was, you know, at that time actually existing like communism and fascism, and like these were vibrant forces in the 20th century. And FDR was the center, and it was just consensus and practical and whatever.
And he caved a lot to the communists, to the socialists to say, hey, look, you'll be in the coalition, right? If I give you this thing, if I give you that thing. Right? And that works. You need that counterbalancing pressure to sort of drag him to the proper position. And now we don't have socialist movements. We don't have communist movements. We don't have a true vibrant left. And so it feels like we're just screwed in perpetuity.
Let's talk about your background for a moment. So both you and I are from a very similar area. I come from an upper middle class background. You do as well. How did you get pilled on social democracy? How did you get pilled on the left?
Reading Noam Chomsky was the first thing, probably. I think the awareness and consciousness came first around foreign policy. Hegemony or Survival, a Noam Chomsky book sort of lays that out. So that's one way. I just consumed all the political things I could. You know, like anything that was political, I was just interested in.
Is that books, media?
So, what? Yeah. So, I loved Tom Hartman, the Air America radio host. He is still the GOAT to this day. I absolutely love that guy. People should check out Tom Hartman if they haven't. Of course, old school Cenk Uygur, back in the days where he was one of the only voices fighting against the Iraq War.
Right.
When he had his Air America show, and then they had the Young Turks in LA, and they went independent and stuff like that. So I would take everything in. And of course, I was big on, because it was the Bush era, as soon as the Iraq War started happening, I started reading the news and like following the news and what was going on. And so the awakening, I think, first happened when it came to foreign policy type stuff and how we were an empire and we were the global bully, and that really sort of irked me. And then the economic stuff came a little bit later. You know, I had my dad passed away at age 56 in 2011 from lung cancer. He was a lifetime smoker. He died from lung cancer. And he didn't have insurance. And leading up to that, he went to a chiropractor. And the chiropractor said, I know your back hurts. Please keep coming back here. We'll fix this. We'll like keep working it out. And he went and he did that. Well, that back pain that he was experiencing that he was going to the chiropractor for, it was a tumor. And it started in his lungs and metastasized to his spine. And the fact that he didn't have health insurance,
right,
and he was going to this chiropractor, it was very clear that he felt like the chiropractor is a real doctor who's giving him real treatment. And, you know, it would have been expensive to actually go to a real doctor, right? And that was a moment, too, where I thought, like, if we just had universal healthcare, my dad could have just went to a real doctor, perhaps when he first felt the pain, right, and maybe they could have caught the cancer at stage 2 instead of stage 4, and he died soon thereafter, as soon as they found it, right?
Yeah.
And so that was another awakening where even myself, growing up in an upper-middle-class family, you know, my dad, he had sold his business, and he was retired, and he didn't have insurance, and
right,
even he would be counted in the statistic of dying from lack of healthcare.
He
right?
actually did okay, but the system still didn't work for him.
Correct. And so that was you know, an awakening moment. And yeah, the rest is history. I mean, a lot of it is just from reading the news and the horrors of the Bush administration that sort of radicalized me to a left-wing position.
Yeah. How did you come across Chomsky first?
How did I come across Chomsky first? I would say I was introduced to him by a professor. It was it was a college professor. And it was some political science class, because of course I majored in political science. And he said about Chomsky, this is a guy who's so brilliant and so intelligent and so good at debating, they don't allow him on TV. And I remember hearing that going, I gotta watch this guy, right? And so, and you mentioned an old debate earlier. There's also an old debate between Chomsky and William F. Buckley. There's that's on YouTube. There's also an old debate, Chomsky and Foucault.
Yep.
That's on YouTube.
Great memes.
Great stuff, yeah. And yeah, so that's how I came across Chomsky, and I read a bunch of his books.
Did you always want to be a political commentator back then?
Yeah. Wow. So when I was like a kid, I was more, you know, I wanted to be a professional athlete, and I bounced around from sport to sport, depending on the year.
What was your main sport?
Well, I played soccer. I played golf. I played basketball. But for whatever reason, when I was a kid, I wanted to be like a professional football player, and I wanted to be a professional hockey player.
Okay.
So not the ones I even ended up playing. I did play some hockey, but I was very young at the time. But when I actually hit the age where it's like you can start thinking about what you want to do for the rest of your life, I always said, at the time, Air America was still on the air, and I said, I want to be an Air America radio host.
Wow.
I wanted to be like the left-wing answer to Rush Limbaugh. I basically started doing that in my grandma's basement in 2008 and started doing it full-time in 2012. Just on YouTube.
I find this to be a very inspiring story, actually. Wow. In that time, did you ever use a different political label?
Did I ever use a different political label? No, I think I'm like most people where, you know, it was like for a time, people didn't even really talk about leftism. They would just say liberal, you know?
Yeah,
so I would say I'm liberal or I'm very liberal.
Yeah.
And then it became progressive became the term, you know, that people used for a while. And I used the term progressive. And then I would say it was sometime after progressive, you know, started saying social democrat. And now I just probably use the term leftist. Though it's always been in that ballpark.
Yeah, yeah, okay. How do you tell what to take seriously online? How do you differentiate irony and real world politics?
Dude, I can't. I'm the worst at it. I swear. Crystal jokes, like, I'm not actually autistic, but I'm kind of autistic. And so things always go right over my fucking head.
Yeah.
Like something will be an obvious joke and I'm like, what the fuck is this? And it's like, it's a joke, Kyle. Oh, all right. So I'm like the last person you should ever ask. But I feel like that very literal mindedness has helped me throughout my time online. Because perhaps I take things seriously that others might not take seriously. And so you evaluate something others might not evaluate. It might help out, but I am literally the last person who can give you a solid answer on that.
Yeah, it's interesting because Hassan said a similar thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I wonder if like being like somewhat on the spectrum, like just a touch of the tism rather than like the full blown, if that, I don't know, somehow like positions you to be a better content creator somehow.
It's possible. You know, it's also, it's funny too. People look at me and they think I'm extroverted because of what I do for a living. It's the exact opposite. On the spectrum, I am the most introverted you could possibly be. If you leave me in a room with a fucking laptop, I can stay in there for a month, no problems whatsoever.
Yeah,
won't bother anybody, won't say anything, I'll just be in my own world. And I actually, in a weird way, I actually think the introversion also helps with my show. I let out all of the feelings on air, and then I just go back to chilling and doing nothing. I'm the least extroverted person you've ever seen. So yeah, I think that touch of the tism and being introverted actually makes for a great mix to be a content creator like I am, to do as much content as I do.
Right.
And I have a feeling that if you were to ask all of the people who do this show, I think most of them would say, I'm very introverted and I'm a little bit autistic.
There is a there's a profound difference of like talking to a stream, like a Twitch stream, like to a camera webcam, versus like being in front of a live audience. And I've done a few like public speaking things that's part of art and like museum panel discussions and whatever. And it feels totally, totally different. Like sitting here with you is so much easier than like when you have, you know, 50 people who are in this like leaning forward, examining everything that you say. It's like all of a sudden it's like you feel it physically, like your heart rate and everything. You're very aware of being watched, even though now there's going to be orders of magnitude more people that see this, but it feels much more comfortable. It's totally bizarre.
It's funny you say that because I feel the opposite.
Really?
I am better. The more people you get in front of them, the more I'll kill it.
Okay.
The more I can lock in, the more I can say everything I want to say. It really makes me step it up.
Should we get a live audience?
Yeah, get a live audience. This place might be a little too hot if we do that. But
yeah,
it's the exact opposite. I've done my show live and not live on and off throughout the years. Right now I'm going through a stretch of doing it not live. But I've been thinking about maybe going back to live because I feel like it forces you to roll with whatever the fuck comes out of your mouth.
Yep.
Whereas if you're just recording it, sometimes I'll say something and then my mind goes, is that exactly how I wanted to say that? And I might stop and go back, I don't like that. Yeah. I like the element of communication that's more like you're shooting from the hip, you're being authentic, wherever it goes. If you fuck it up, you got to clean it up yourself.
Right.
And so I've been toying with the idea of going back to live.
Yeah, I feel a similar way where like when I'm doing this show, like I'm the host, so I'm trying to be the straight man and everything. And like, if I flub a line, I'll just like retake it and we'll like cut it out. But when I'm on someone else's show and I know it's live and it's not going to be cut, and it's just like my delivery for everything is flawless because like, it's like jumping without a net.
Gotta do it.
All of a sudden, it's like, well, can't fuck this up.
No choice. No safety net.
As an introvert, you're spending a lot of time on the computer. I think some part of the politics that are expressed on today's social media are the product of like introverted people who would silently have their opinions being allowed to let them loose.
Totally.
Did you have other internet-based hobbies? Were you a gamer? Did you participate in message boards? Or like, what did you do in your grandma's basement that wasn't live streaming?
I jacked off. Does that count?
I guess that counts, Hi, everybody. This is Joshua Citarella. What you just heard is an excerpt from this week's bonus episode. If you want to hear more and get access to the full catalog for Doomscroll and other podcasts, you can support the show on Patreon or Substack, where I'm putting out new episodes every week. This is an independent show. I don't do any advertising, so your support is really what keeps this project going. Thanks for listening. See you again soon.